Despite this, it appears possible that France might be headed for its own George Floyd moment, where its racial injustices are finally reckoned with.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Chapter Ali Imran from the Holy Quran, verses number 29 and 30, recited by Saeed Maliki.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Qul in تخفوا ما في صدوركم أو تبدوه يعلمه الله ويعلم ما في السماوات وما في الأرض والله على كل شيء قدير يوم تجد كل نفس ما عملت من خير محضرا وما عملت من سوء تود لو أن بينها وبينه أمدا بعيدا ويحذركم
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, whether you hide what is in your heart or manifest it, Allah knows it. And He knows whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth. And Allah has power over all things. On the day that every soul shall find present what it has done of good and what it has done of evil, it shall wish that between it and that evil there were a long duration of time. And Allah makes you to be cautious of retribution from Himself, and Allah is compassionate to the servants.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
These are the top stories. Iran criticizes the UN nuclear watchdog for its, quote, flawed confidentiality mechanism, saying the IAEA is responsible for the leak of a recent confidential letter. The United Nations and the European Union called for a probe into the death of a Palestinian teenager at the hands of an Israeli soldier. Also in the headlines, violent clashes erupt in the U.S. state of Washington during rallies held by an anti-racism movement and opposing protesters. Welcome to the program. Our top story, Iran says it'll shortly take legal action over the leak of a confidential letter sent by Tehran to the International Atomic Energy Agency. Iran's permanent representative to Vienna-based international organizations held the IAEA responsible for the incident, saying that the agency's confidentiality mechanisms are seriously flawed. Kazem Gharibabadi noted that Iran's reports to the agency have been repeatedly divulged to media while still considered as confidential. Gharibabadi stressed that reporting confidential information without following the declassification procedure is illegal. The letter in question contained information on Iran's safeguard measures and its nuclear enrichment plan in the central city of Natanz. Our correspondent in Vienna says Iran is concerned that a leak of information about its nuclear program could endanger the security of its nuclear facilities and the lives of its nuclear scientists.
But this isn't the first time that this has happened. This has happened numerous times before, especially when it comes to the reports that the agency has on monitoring and verification of the JCPOA in Iran. So this has happened before. There certainly hasn't been a sense of urgency when it came to previous instances, and right now with the tweet that the Iranian ambassador gave, there hasn't still been any official response from the IAEA. The IAEA has generally said before that it takes the issue of confidentiality seriously. Iran says the only option that Iran is left with is to pursue this legally, because this has not just happened today or this time, it's happened before. And in some cases, Iran is saying it has actually endangered the lives of Iranian nuclear scientists. The names of people who've been mentioned in these reports, for instance, those people have come under threat. We know about, of course, the assassinations of nuclear scientists, and the sabotage attempts against Iranian nuclear facilities. So this has real consequences for Iran. And unfortunately, it's only the reports on Iran that are leaked to the media and not reports on other countries, because, of course, that's because the IAEA has the most extensive inspections regime in Iran.
The European Union has denounced the killing of a Palestinian teenager by the Israeli army as a war crime. The EU delegation to Palestine called for a thorough investigation into the incident, noting that the international law recognizes special protection for minors. The fatal shooting of the teenager also drew condemnation from the UN's Middle East envoy. Nikolai Mladenov said he was appalled by the killing, describing the incident as shocking and unacceptable. Palestinian factions also denounced the killing. Ali Abu Alia, who was targeted with a bullet during a Friday protest against Israeli settlements in a village near the city of Ramallah, he was laid to rest on Saturday following a funeral ceremony in the same city. Now, Israelis have held fresh demonstrations against their own Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in Jerusalem, Al-Quds. Protesters gathered outside Netanyahu's residence to condemn his policies and call for his resignation. The demonstration was held despite a ban on protests. Israelis have been staging street rallies over the past months to protest soaring unemployment, a hike in COVID-19 infections, and a return of coronavirus restrictions. Adding to anti-regime sentiments are the corruption charges facing the prime minister. Netanyahu went on trial back in May for bribery, fraud, and breach of trust, but he denies any wrongdoing. Clashes erupt in the U.S. state of Washington during counter-rallies by anti-racism protesters and supporters of President Donald Trump. The violence broke out after members of anti-fascist political movement Antifa wearing black suits burned American flags during a rally dubbed Squash Fascists in the state capital Olympia. Counter-protesters retaliated by beating Antifa members with American and Trump flag posts. Police say there was at least one arrest after a pro-Trump supporter fired a handgun into the opposing crowd. Anti-racism protests were also planned elsewhere, including in St. Paul and Minneapolis. The country has seen a number of anti-racism protests since the death of George Floyd at the hands of white police officers, I should say, late in May. U.S. President Donald Trump has reiterated his claims of election fraud in last month's presidential vote.
I think they say that if you win Florida and if you win Ohio, in history, you've never lost an election. This has got to be a first time. But the truth is, they were right. We've never lost an election. We're winning this election.
Trump made the comments in a campaign rally for two Georgia Republican senators who face runoffs in early January. The U.S. president and some of his fellow Republicans have rejected the result of the November the 3rd election, claiming that the vote was rigged in favor of the Democrats. But her claims have been rejected by state and federal officials, and her numerous legal challenges have all failed. In the meantime, Joe Biden officially secured the 270 electoral votes needed to enter the White House after California certified his victory there. Colin Campbell says Trump's claims of fraud may have repercussions for his Republican comrades in Senate who are trying to maintain their narrow majority.
The president's claims and his continued persistence that the vote is not legitimate has created problems for Republicans in Georgia and in other areas, whereas the Republicans in Georgia, some of them are saying that they won't vote at all because they believe that the system is corrupt. And this creates a problem for Republicans because they have a narrow margin of majority in the Senate. They need their candidates to win in Georgia. And there are two candidates running right now, Kelly Loeffler and David Perdue. If they don't win, if they lose to Ossoff and Dr. Raphael Warnock, then the balance swings to a 50-50 split. And who breaks that 50-50 split if there is a disagreement over legislation? Well, none other than the vice president. And right now, the vice president-elect, Kamala Harris, is expected to become officially the vice president on January 20th. So if you have a current president who's saying that the vote is illegitimate and that the system is corrupt and that the voting is rigged, and Republicans believe this narrative that their vote really doesn't count and they don't come out to show up for the election, well, then he's essentially handing it over to Democrats, which would further mire any type of influence that the Republicans wish to have with a Democrat in the executive branch and, of course, a majority of Democrats in the House of Representatives.
Fatalities from COVID-19 in the U.S. have surpassed the grim milestone of 280,000 as the virus continues to wreak havoc across that country. This comes as the U.S. once again shattered its own record for daily COVID-19 cases for the third day in a row, with some 230,000 new infections. The total confirmed coronavirus cases now exceed 14,500,000 in the U.S., which, by the way, remains the world's worst-hit country in terms of both infections and deaths. Top American health expert Dr. Anthony Fauci says some areas may need to reimpose draconian measures. Meanwhile, in Brazil, officials reported over 43,000 new coronavirus cases with over 660 deaths. This raises the country's overall death toll to over 176,000 out of over 6.5 million cases. Remaining in the U.S., where Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has rejected a new bipartisan $908 billion stimulus plan put forward in an effort to break the legislative stalemate as the coronavirus surges on throughout the country. The plan aims to address the expiration of key economic aid programs, including an unemployment insurance extension. Wyatt Reed reports.
For the millions of Americans facing possible eviction and the end of emergency unemployment benefits, it seems for now that little help is on the way, at least from Congress. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer said that a proposed new COVID-19 relief package, backed by centrist Republicans and Democrats, should serve as an opening bid in negotiations with Republicans. It's a far cry from the $2.2 trillion bill House Democrats approved in October, and economist Dr. Jack Rasmus says Republicans are unlikely to allow this latest measure to pass either.
We have a centrist coalition here of Democrats and Republicans in the Senate trying to break that roadblock that Mitch McConnell and Trump represent. It's sort of a compromise between where the Democrats were and where, Mitch McConnell and Trump are. I don't think it's going to go very far because McConnell's made it clear just yesterday or today that he's not going to offer more than $500 billion. He doesn't care.
With Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin promising to block his replacement, Janet Yellen, from disbursing $455 billion in unspent CARES Act funds, the $500 billion package Republicans are offering would likely consist almost entirely of money Congress already allocated to COVID-19 relief. In the meantime, tens of millions of Americans face the looming threat of eviction as a CDC moratorium expires this month, and over 12 million are set to lose unemployment benefits the day after Christmas. Hunger is rampant, and it's expected that over 50 million people will suffer from food insecurity by the year's end. With so many facing increasingly dire circumstances, authorities in some states are working to bridge the gap in benefits on their own. Legislators in Michigan, Colorado, and Minnesota are currently eyeing measures to make sure that happens if Congress doesn't step in. But according to Dr. Rasmus, that may be easier said than done.
State and local governments, in this $908 billion, I think $180 billion was proposed, state and local governments that are going broke and are laying off workers by the hundreds of thousands now because they have no revenue at a critical time when they've got to be involved with distributing, the vaccines. So state and local governments are really in a desperate situation.
The desperation doesn't end there. The slow-motion tsunami of unemployment and homelessness is already starting to occur in cities all over the country. But for now, there's little many Americans can do but pray that help arrives in time. Wyatt Reed, Washington.
Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro has slammed the U.S. sanctions against his country, adding that they have taken away 99% of the Latin American nation's income in dollar every year. Maduro asked Venezuelans that is to elect socialist deputies in the upcoming parliamentary elections so that his party can better fight off the U.S. measures against his country. All the way from Caracas, here's Jesus Silva.
As legislative election day approaches in Venezuela, incumbent President Nicolas Maduro has announced that 99% of the nation's dollar income has been deprived by the series of illegal economic sanctions imposed by the government of the United States. Maduro added that the American government uses these sanctions to bring about the country's economic collapse and achieve his ousting from the presidency. Maduro outlined that although the ongoing U.S. blockade will not get him out of his office, it is ruining his country's economy. The Venezuelan leader said his government has had tough times bearing with the U.S. economic aggression.
99% of the dollars Venezuela used to obtain every year is now gone as a result of Washington illegal measures against us.
Nonetheless, Maduro seemed enthusiastic about the preliminary election as a key step to win the spat with the U.S., and members of his ruling party agree.
Once a socialist majority is elected in the National Assembly, Maduro's legal battle against U.S. sanctions will be stronger.
But within the opposition, many stand by the ongoing U.S. blockade.
I welcome U.S. punishing measures in Venezuela as they are the only way to put pressure on the Maduro regime and bring about free elections.
Meanwhile, experts say U.S. measures against Venezuela violate international law.
U.S. sanctions on Venezuela have been devastating, shrinking the country's income and impoverishing millions of people. This is against the law.
While U.S. economic sanctions have severely affected Venezuela's economy, Maduro calls on people to vote for his socialist party in the legislative elections, claiming the socialist lawmakers will work with him to overcome such sanctions. Jesus Silva, Caracas.
In Europe, police in the French capital of Paris have clashed with protesters angry at police brutality and a new security bill. The protesters vandalized buildings and set fire to cars and barricades. They also threw projectiles at riot police, who fired tear gas to break up the protesters. Paris police say 30 people have been arrested. A similar rally took place in the northern city of Lille. Demonstrators want the government to withdraw the bill that curbs rights to circulate images of police officers. They say the bill would limit freedoms and allow police brutality to go undiscovered and unpunished. President Emmanuel Macron's ruling party has said it would rewrite part of the bill.
The coordination Stop Global Security Law organized a new popular march for liberties and for justice all over France. The protesters want a total withdrawal of a law recently voted in the French parliament that limits the possibility to film the police. They also denounce an authoritarian drift of the French government.
That authoritarian drift is evident. Look to the proposed laws. The existing legal framework in France is more than sufficient to control everything they want to. Why do they add new laws? It's only to limit more the freedom of expression and to sanction activists.
Trade unions say that the French government is taking advantage of the COVID-19 crisis to implement anti-social and austerity measures like the privatization of the health sector and the dismissal of workers.
They use the Terrorist Act and the health crisis as an alibi for restrictive measures. Since last week, the head of police has forbidden a demonstration in name of the COVID-19 crisis. This law has only one interest, to silence demonstrators.
Earlier this week, the Council of Ministers decided to close the main association against Islamophobia in France, the CCIF, French Interior Minister Darmanin qualified the CCIF as an enemy of the Republic and accused it of incitement to hatred and violence, discrimination, and of encouraging terrorism.
That's very surprising, because the CCIF has always profiled itself on the judicial scene and very little as political activists. The association limited itself to defend the legitimate rights of the Muslims. Now, in the context of an upsurge of terrorist attacks since 2015, the French government has entered in a phase of escalation of repressive measures that seriously limit the democratic liberties.
Amnesty International declared that dissolving the CCIF is a violation of freedom of association. As for now, the French government remains inflexible towards the social protest. The tensions are rising in high government circles about the way the security issue in France is handled. The protesters promise not to give up until an important part of the law is cancelled. Chris Denhant, Paris.
Diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
On Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary. O possessor of pardon and good pleasure, from wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian and thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to thee, addressing myself to thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to you for the hope of your rewards. So, bless Muhammad, the best of thy creation, the summoner to thy truth. Exalt me with thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely, thou art the all-forgiving, the all-compassionate.
Limelight. Over the past 11 months, about 20,000 people have braved the Atlantic route from Africa to Europe, with more than 8,000 arriving in the Canaries in November alone. Last year, 2,557 migrants arrived in the archipelago, up from 1,307 in 2018. Nowhere is the strain and chaos more evident than on the dock at Arguineguin. At a makeshift receptor center cobbled together 4 months ago and intended to shelter 500 people, the number of occupants has swelled to almost 2,700 over recent weeks. According to official figures, Arguineguin has a population of 2,309. The people held at the temporary center, officially for a maximum of 72 hours, are living in cramped conditions, some in tents, but many sleeping under sun-baked, rat-infested bare dock. We now present you an article written by Eduardo Rabena and Sam Jones. The piece is titled, "This Lack of Humanity Can't Go On. Canary Islands Struggle with Huge Rise in Migration." The article has been taken from the website of the British newspaper The Guardian. Stay with us for more of Eduardo Rabena and Sam Jones's article. Canary Islands 2020 will be remembered as more than just the year of the coronavirus. The streets of Arguineguin, a small town on the island of Gran Canaria, has thronged not with tourists in search of winter warmth, but with police officers, health workers, and journalists, all scurrying to and from the crowded dock, which has become the newest symbol of an old phenomenon. Almost 15 years after the Cayuco crisis of 2006, when about 36,000 people reached the Spanish archipelago in small and dangerous cayucos or fishing boats, the Canaries are once again struggling to cope with the arrival of thousands of migrants and refugees. Over the past 11 months, about 20,000 people have braved the Atlantic route from Africa to Europe, with more than 8,000 arriving in the Canaries in November alone. Last year, 2,557 migrants arrived in the archipelago, up from 1,307 in 2018. Nowhere is the strain and chaos more evident than on the dock at Arguineguin. At the makeshift reception center cobbled together 4 months ago and intended to shelter just 500 people, the number of occupants has swelled to almost 2,700 over recent weeks. According to official figures, Arguineguin has a population of just 2,309. The people held at the temporary center officially for a maximum of 72 hours, arriving in cramped conditions, some in tents, but many sleeping under sun-baked, rat-infested bear dog. Most of their fellow arrivals have progressed to purported better-equipped temporary camps further inland, government reception centers, or hotel rooms. There has been a rise in the use of the Atlantic route this year amid enduring conflicts, land border closures forced by the pandemic, and increased controls in some North African countries. Smuggling gangs have reactivated the long and perilous crossing, ferrying thousands of men, women, and children between the two continents. Those lucky enough to land on the Canaries find themselves pitched into a confused, disjointed, and under-resourced system. Spain's public ombudsman has called for the Arguineguín camp to be shut down at once on the grounds that it could be violating people's basic rights. Recently, a judge claimed that while the conditions at the camp were deplorable, they did not constitute a crime. The complaint had been brought by the Onalio Bueno, the mayor of the municipality of Mogán, of which Arguineguín is a part. Citing the events of 17th of November in particular, Mayor Onalio Bueno despairs at the lack of coordination between central government ministries. That day, as the dock center was completely overwhelmed, 200 Moroccans were removed by police officers, put on buses bound for the island's capital, Las Palmas, and left without anywhere to stay. While the Migration Ministry finally stepped in and found accommodation for them, Mayor Onalio Bueno says the event was symptomatic of a deep and troubling absence of political will. She says this lack of humanity from the government just can't go on, adding, "It doesn't seem to be able to solve the problem at hand." And yet, she adds, Spain found its way through the Cayuco crisis in 2006. José Segura Clavel, who was the central government's representative in the Canaries at the time, says the two situations do not bear comparison. Segura Clavel points out that the pandemic means repatriation flights are impossible, but says the migrants and refugees are not getting the humanitarian reception to which they're entitled. However, José Segura Clavel adds if Spanish authorities are failing to live up to their obligations, then so is the European Union. It says the EU's behavior is a mistake, adding, "We don't have a clear common policy." The lack of a clear, common, and fair approach to migration was spelt out in the letter that Spain, Italy, Greece, and Malta sent to the European Commission recently in response to the European Union's new migration and asylum proposals. The four countries said, "We believe that the solidarity rules and the related commitments of all member states must be clearly defined," adding, "The frontline member states cannot face the migratory pressure on the whole of the European Union. We must find feasible and coordinated solutions to our common challenges." In the meantime, the pressure at the Arguineguín dock is belatedly easing. Each day, people are being transferred to a former military camp on the island, which can house up to 1,000 people. But there are fears the winter rains could turn the camp into a mud bath. About 6,000 people, including more than 455 unaccompanied children, are being put up in hotel rooms paid for by the Spanish government. More than 3,470 of them are staying in 10 hotels in Mogán. But things are far from settled, and tempers far from cool. Recently, Mayor Bueno issued an ultimatum to the Migration Ministry warning that Mogán Solidarity has a best-before date of 31st of December, and asking the central government to remove the migrants and refugees from hotels and accommodate them elsewhere. We'll be right back. Secretary of State for Migrations, Hanna Jalul, said the Interior Ministry was working to repatriate all those not eligible for asylum, but added that the new arrivals needed to be properly looked after. Jalul said recently, "If I left those migrants on the streets right now, social services would have to take responsibility for them," adding, "Do you think that the mayor has the resources to house 3,400 migrants? Silvanus Camara, a 22-year-old migrant from Sierra Leone, is one of those staying in a hotel. Although the Interior Ministry, which is trying to shut down the dock camp as soon as possible, says no one stays on the docks for more than 72 hours, Silvanus Camara spent 8 days at the camp. On a recent visit, Human Rights Watch spoke to people who had been held there for more than 2 weeks. Like many of his fellow migrants, Camara clambered into a crowded boat in the Senegalese port of Mbour one day in October in search of a future. Faced with a lack of work and prospects at home, he decided to gamble on the dangerous sea crossing, leaving his 5-year-old daughter in the care of his sister. But unlike most of the new arrivals in the Canaries, Silvanus Camara has no plans to move to the mainland. One of the few items he brought with him is the strip of the local football team, UD Las Palmas, whose matches he used to watch back home. Camara says the Canaries, a great place, remind him of Africa. His dream now is to pick up the nascent football career he left behind in Sierra Leone. He rises at about 6 a.m. local time every day to train on the beach 2 miles away and hopes his dedication will pay off. Camara says, "I was doing my exercises when a trainer from the local team came over and offered me the chance to train with them. Anything more permanent will depend on the young Sierra Leonean sorting out his papers, something that already overstretched Red Cross is trying to help him with." The frustration and anger expressed by local people and politicians is echoed by some of the non-governmental organizations sharing the strain. For Texema Santana of the Spanish Commission for Refugee Aid, the conversion of the military camp just goes to show that there could have been an alternative to the dock center a long time ago. Like many others, not least the regional president of the Canaries, Texema Santana sees clear parallels between what is happening on the archipelago and what has already happened in Lampedusa in Italy and Lesbos in Greece. The numbers may differ, but the response does not. Texema Santana says the European Union views island territories as prisons. But for those less fortunate, the Canaries and the waters that lead to them are not prisons, but cemeteries. In October, at least 140 people died when the boat carrying them from Senegal caught fire and capsized in the deadliest shipwreck recorded so far this year. Recently, 8 people died when their boat ran into rocks as they attempted to land on Lanzarote in Canaries. According to the International Organization for Migration, IOM, at least 563 people have died in the Atlantic Ocean in 2020, trying to cross from Africa into the Canaries. The figure does not take into account the Lanzarote deaths, nor the 10 other possible but unconfirmed shipwrecks that the International Organization for Migration, IOM, is looking into. Texema Santana says, "Until we have a safe, legal and organized way for people to move about, we're going to carry on seeing these irregular crossings." He added, "There will always be people ready to traffic other people and to sell them the dream of reaching another land."
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
The imperialist war of aggression against Syria has been raging on now for almost a decade. Foreign actors haven't interfered just on the battlefield. They've also been waging a war of words and ideas using a vast propaganda network. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. In 2011, during the so-called Arab Spring, what started out in Syria as a supposed popular uprising or revolution quickly turned out to be a very complex proxy war involving numerous actors, very powerful Western governments, and Arab kingdoms in the Persian Gulf. Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Israel, the United Kingdom, the United States worked together to fund and train hardline Islamist groups inside of Syria in order to implement regime change and overthrow the Syrian government. These groups were supplied with radios, medical equipment, weapons, munitions, and much more. However, the war against Syria hasn't been waged just with weapons and just on the battlefield. It's also involved words, ideas, propaganda. And so these nations wielded the power of the mainstream media in order to craft a certain narrative and change public opinion about what is going on inside of Syria. One of the biggest lies of this war is the alleged gas attack that took place in Douma, a scandal that continues to this day. In April 2018, we heard allegations that the Syrian army had dropped chemical weapons on civilians in Douma. Now, at this time, the Syrian army was undertaking Operation Damascus Steel to take back the region of Ghouta, which is in the countryside of Damascus. Most of Ghouta was already back under the government's control. So why would they use chemical weapons when they're winning this campaign? That makes absolutely no sense strategically or militarily. Why would the Syrian government do the one thing that would guarantee foreign intervention and a bombing campaign by the US and the UK? That makes absolutely no sense. Moreover, the Syrian government had already gotten rid of its chemical weapons stockpile in 2014, which was overseen by the international community. So where are these weapons coming from exactly? Nonetheless, the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, the OPCW, sent a fact-finding mission to Douma to investigate what had taken place. Thanks to leaked emails published by WikiLeaks in late 2019, we can see how the OPCW doctored its own report to remove the findings of the team that it sent to Douma. Why? Because these findings showed that no chemical gas attack had taken place. Bit by bit, we saw how inspectors complained internally that what was being shown in the preliminary report did not match what they found on the ground. The fact-finding mission that was sent by the OPCW concluded that the gas cylinders were not dropped from an aircraft, but had been placed there manually. The inspectors also concluded that there were only trace quantities of chlorine. These could have emanated from household items like bleach. Moreover, the medical examinations showed that the victims, the symptoms that they exhibited did not match those of a chemical gas attack. The OPCW leadership removed these findings from their report because they disproved these allegations that the Syrian army had used chemical weapons. One of the whistleblowers who came forward with these revelations is Ian Henderson. And when he did, the OPCW tried to discredit him, which is absurd considering the fact that Henderson is a veteran inspector at the OPCW and was leading the mission that went to Douma.
The findings in the final FFM report were contradictory, were a complete turnaround with what the team had understood collectively during and after the Douma deployments. And by the time of release of the interim report in July 2018, our understanding was that we had serious misgivings that a chemical attack had occurred.
20 OPCW inspectors expressed their concerns about the report being doctored. And the OPCW then decided to replace the fact-finding mission with a new one. An entirely new team was assembled with members who had not been to the site, save for one medical expert. The evidence is clear. The science is clear. The chemical weapons inspectors themselves from the OPCW could not find any evidence of a chemical gas attack. This has never been corrected by the OPCW nor the mainstream media. As a matter of fact, the United Kingdom, the United States, France didn't even wait for the OPCW report, for this doctored report to even come out. They just went right ahead and bombed Syria a few days later in April 2018. And last month in October, these same countries blocked Jose Bustani, the former director of the OPCW, from testifying at the UN Security Council.
Of particular concern are the circumstances surrounding the OPCW's investigation of the alleged chemical attack in Douma, Syria, on April the 7th, 2018. These concerns are emanating from the very heart of the organization, from the very scientists and engineers involved in the Douma investigation. Now, almost 1 year later, the OPCW has still not responded to these requests, nor to the ever-growing controversy surrounding the Douma investigation. Rather, it has hidden behind an impenetrable wall of silence and opacity, making any meaningful dialogue impossible. The inspectors in the Douma investigation have a simple request, that they be given the opportunity to meet with you, Mr. Chairman, to express their concerns to you in person, in a manner that is both transparent and accountable. If the OPCW is confident in the robustness of its scientific work on Douma and in the integrity of the investigation, then it should have little to fear in hearing out its inspectors. If, however, the claims of evidence suppression, selective use of data, and exclusion of key investigators, among other allegations, are not unfounded, then it's even more imperative that the issue be dealt with openly and urgently.
When Bustani was the head of the OPCW during the Bush years, John Bolton came to The Hague personally and threatened him and his family if he did not resign because he was getting in the way of Washington's attempts to topple Saddam Hussein and go for regime change in Iraq. And so when Jose Bustani tried to testify at the UN Security Council and plead that the OPCW listen to its own inspectors and look at the science, look at the evidence from the Douma site, he was blocked. I don't think the irony is lost on anyone that in the same chamber, the same body, in front of the UN Security Council in 2003, Colin Powell sat there and lied about weapons of mass destruction that Iraq did not possess And here we are 17 years later in front of the same body, and we're seeing the same movie being played out. How anyone can believe allegations about WMDs emanating from Western governments after 2003 is truly beyond me. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
One of the key voices in amplifying these allegations of chemical weapons being used, and not just in Douma, by the way, are the white helmets. You may have heard about the white helmets or seen their videos where they're running in the midst of battle and rescuing victims from the rubble, being portrayed as these benevolent actors. But the truth is far more sinister than that. Just recently, a trove of leaked documents revealed in detail how the United Kingdom and its allies poured millions of pounds into contractor groups. These contractor groups were created by former British intelligence and set up in countries near Syria, like Turkey and the United Arab Emirates. They included groups like ARC or IncoStrat, Albany, and all of them founded by figures with backgrounds in British intelligence, in the British military, or the Foreign and Commonwealth Office. These organizations were not only created by Western intelligence, they were funded by the same countries trying to overthrow the Syrian government and implement regime change in Syria. These groups like ARC worked very closely with Western mainstream media in order to craft this narrative about the war in Syria and change public opinion. They pushed the line that Syria and Russia are evil and amplified the voices of opposition figures, and even tried to rehabilitate the image of hardline Islamist groups as moderate rebels. So while the Western media tried to portray the white helmets as these noble humanitarian actors, and Netflix even produced an Oscar-winning documentary, and they were nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize, what the Western media never told you is that their founder, James Lemessurier, is not a Syrian. He's British former intelligence and former army. And all these Western cutouts that were funding the white helmets and running their social media accounts and trying to rehabilitate the image of jihadists as moderate rebels were being run and funded by the same governments trying to overthrow the Syrian government and implement regime change in Syria. That part was conveniently left out, as were the parts about the white helmets participating in executions on video and using the same offices and headquarters as Al-Nusra Front, which is an offshoot of Al-Qaeda. I'm joined by Canadian journalist Eva Bartlett. Eva, you spent a long time in Syria. You covered Douma and the white helmets. Could you tell us more about your time there?
I first went to Syria in April 2014. I spent a couple of weeks there with a peace delegation, and afterwards came back on a journalist visa in June 2014. And since then, I've been to Syria 14 times. At points during 2016, I was spending 2 months, and then later on 2 months.
You did a lot of coverage on the white helmets. You've received a lot of attacks because of this in the mainstream media. Why is that? What did you discover exactly about the white helmets that they don't like?
Yeah, I mean, I would also just add to it, the mainstream media doesn't like to hear anything from Syrian civilians that doesn't mesh with their narrative on Syria, which is, you know, everything about the Syrian government and army bad, everything about their precious quote-unquote rebels good. And so what other journalists, primarily Vanessa Healy, as you know, and myself have discovered is that the white helmets are not the virtuous rescue team that their backers would have us believe. They're heavily funded by Western governments, working hand in hand with Al Qaeda and other extremists in Syria. And you know, this is all right from information that's available online. But then when you talk to Syrian civilians, they'll tell you about how they, for example, could not get close to the white helmets because they were not allowed to. I was told that by numerous civilians, which begs the question: how are the white helmets rescuing so many people if civilians tell us that we can't go near them because they're always with the terrorist groups? Civilians also spoke of white helmets going with terrorists and staging scenes that presumably were like some sort of rescue scene, throwing smoke bombs and then pretend rescuing people. I mean, this is civilian testimony, but I did hear it numerous times. And they, in Aleppo in 2018, an older man I spoke with near the citadel told me, quote, he said the civil defense, which is the name they go by, is supposed to rescue people, but they used to steal women's earrings from the dead bodies. If she was wearing gold, they'd cut her hand to steal it. They're thieves, not rescuers. We saw them murdering people many times. So, and I also was in Eastern Ghouta some weeks after the allegations of a chemical attack having occurred there, and I spent a few hours walking around different districts, Douma, Kafatna, Safa, talking with people, and I was asking, of course, you know, did they have any information about whether or not a chemical attack had occurred, because you would assume living in those areas, they'd either experienced it or their loved ones in the area had experienced it. And none of them had anything to say. They all thought it was, they either didn't have anything to say or they thought no attack had occurred. Some speculated that it was Jaish al-Islam trying to intimidate them, which was a common thing that terrorists do, by the way. They intimidate civilians there by saying, you know, if you leave this area, the Syrian government or the Syrian army is going to murder you, rape your women. So some are speculating that at the time that they were being, you know, intimidated by Jaish al-Islam. But most of them wanted to tell me about how horrible their lives had been under, whether it was Jaish al-Islam or Falah Khan or whichever, you know, how they'd been starved and tortured and how there was point-blank executions in the streets for all to see. So this is the kind of thing that most of the people I was meeting wanted to tell me about, but I did ask them about white helmets. And so, for example, again, I heard they were only working with terrorist groups, Jaish al-Islam. They were supposed to be for civilians, but they were the contrary. And one guy said, Jaish al-Islam used to attack us wearing a white helmet one day, and leaving it behind another day. And so I have other testimonies from people from those areas. But also, I think just one other thing to note is that in Douma, in the medical point, the underground makeshift hospital that we all saw in white helmets and other clips purporting to be treating civilians that were allegedly attacked with a chemical weapon, I spoke with medical staff there who told me, as this is now a very well-known story, but anyway, he said, you know, what staff were treating were people that were coming in for normal shelling injuries, suffocation injuries, gas or dust inhalations. I asked them, like, were any of the staff wearing protective uniforms if they had allegedly been treating chemical weapons victims? He said, of course not. And I said, well, were any of the staff ill or anything like that? And he said, no. And he said, all the people that they treated that day were sent home.
The BBC released a new radio podcast where they tried to whitewash the image of James Le Mesurier and the white helmets. And in it, they attacked you and they attacked Vanessa Bealey. What are some of the other smears that they put in there?
Right, so I have to be honest, I haven't listened to the whole thing because it's appallingly awful and it's really painful to listen to. But they're running with a theme that, again, that the white helmets are victims of an attack campaign led by Russia, and that myself and Vanessa and other people are under the thumb of Russia and Syria, and that we don't really know what we're doing kind of thing, and that we're just like allegedly just reading a script provided to us. This is the essence of what they're trying to purvey, even though Vanessa, as you know, has many video interviews with civilians on the white helmets, and I have also. But the other funny thing was that, and it might seem like a minor point, and I personally don't care a whole lot, but it was just funny that in one of the episodes, they interviewed Sean Penn, a well-known actor, and he claims to have met Vanessa, and he describes her, I'm going to paraphrase, he didn't know if he was talking to a crazy activist, a Russian agent, or somebody who was perhaps telling the truth. Roughly what he said. But the thing was, he didn't meet Vanessa Bealey. I met him in late 2016. It was when I was in the US doing the speaking tour after I had left Aleppo in November 2016, and the city had been under intense terrorist attack. And so in my speaking tour, I was talking primarily about the suffering civilians in Aleppo were enduring under these bombardments, you know, with mortars, missiles, gas canister bombs, etc. And so I was touring and I was in LA, and it was arranged for me to meet with Penn. And we met in his home for a couple of hours. And he seemed receptive to information on Syria. He had been there at least once, I was told. He seemed to be interested in what I had to say. It was with a great deal of surprise that he later described me as, that I learned that he described me as, you know, oh, crazy activist, I'm used to, but like a Russian agent, like, come on. But so I if you don't even know who you met in 2016, you know, Vanessa is considerably taller, as I said, blonder, more British than I am. And if he cannot remember that detail, how are we supposed to take as credible anything that he has to say about, you know, Syria, much less the White Helmet?
Did the BBC actually ever provide any evidence to refute your reporting?
No, it's never. It's always character assassination. And you mentioned a previous smear. There was a December 2017 smear by The Guardian, who had their expert, who happened to be a fashion and tech expert, approach us with a very incriminating series of questions about our relationship to the Syrian, Russian, and in my case, DPRK governments, and whether we had any funding by them, and how we were able to go to these countries. And of course, the insinuations were that we're stooges of these governments, right? But then the ensuing character assassinations ensuing smears or reports that they issue are character assassinations. And they don't look at, for example, the testimonies of what Syrian civilians are saying about the conduct of the White Helmets, or seeing them walking with various terrorist factions, or the fact that White Helmets' headquarters are almost always inevitably next door to Al-Qaeda mm-hmm. or other terrorist headquarters. They don't look at any of that. They sling the slurs, you know, Russian agent, conspiracy theorist, a blogger, you know.
In the Western media, you know, the White Helmets are portrayed as these impartial humanitarian actors. You visited the complexes, the offices that they used in Syria. Can you tell us more about what you found there?
I mean, to be honest, I've gone to two. One was in East Ghouta, in